Hey, good evening, Bob. We're back here trying to do a new series. It's going to be a session dedicated to centenary comments and reflections. So I guess we can call it the Augean Stables with Bob and Andrew, as we walk through and see what's going on in this magnificent McLuhan Centenary. Today it's August the 1st in Hawaii, August the 2nd, 2011 in New Zealand. Lovely to be talking to you again, and today we're going to talk about Bob Logan. McLuhan Misunderstood, Setting the Record Straight by Robert K. Logan, and the text of this can be followed on the McLuhan on Maui site, Monday, July 18, 2011. So you had some opening comment that I think you wanted to make.
Yes, walking to the beach today, I was thinking, I would sum up McLuhan, I was wondering about this. McLuhan, via the term medium, which is, or is defined or refers to, the Hendiades of technology and culture. I was thinking about a Hendiades right in the title of his institute, Center for Culture and Technology. You know, what is culture? How is it different from technology? They definitely get mixed up in fitting its weight. And so Hendiades is one by means of two. So you have a Hendiades right in his title. So the definition of medium is the Hendiades of technology and culture. And McLuhan takes that lens and applies it to four themes. He problematizes and then maybe solves the issues of education, pollution, revolution, and evolution. There's four themes that he's wrestling with that come out of the Gutenberg Galaxy: the theme of evolution, the theme of education, the theme of revolution, and the theme of pollution. Those four themes, I thought, I invented today as a new way to describe what McLuhan's doing.
Okay, so automatically what I'm thinking of here is that you told me once that Joyce claimed to have made Finnegan's Wake from two words, and maybe the first of those words is nothing and the second of those words is nothing. And so McLuhan, in his Hendiadic approach, he replays that.
Yeah, or he squares it, so he comes up with four. And so then I was thinking, okay, which book deals with revolution? That's the mediumist massage, because that's in the revolutionary media spectacle year of 67. And a lot of the content of mediumism massage is the striking events of that era, 66-67. So that book deals with revolution. War and Peace and Global Village deals with education. Pollution is covered in Take Today. And evolution is covered in Cliched Archetype. And then you could look at Through the Vanishing Point, City is Classroom, and Culture is a Business. They might fit in those four categories. All four of those categories are under the umbrella of medium in understanding media. Do you know what I mean? It's all about the word medium in understanding media. But then look at the clarification about what is education in the global theater. In the book War and Peace in the Global Village, and he has a section called Education is War and War is Education, are the revolutionary images in the mediumism massage that deals with the emotion of multitude in all different kinds of ways and the resultant fragmentation due to satellite effect. Then pollution, look at Take Today. It talks about the three themes. What does Eric say? They're decentralization versus centralism, hardware versus software, and role-playing versus jobs. And Take Today goes through the inventory of confusion, journalistic confusion, economic professors' confusion over the pollution of the information highway, which is the new economy. So that's why I'm putting pollution in Take Today, and because he blatantly talks and makes an inventory of the services and disservices in Take Today, which he didn't really do in previous books. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Talks about drop in and drop out, rim spins, the side effects. And then the evolution is in Cliché Archetype, where he problematizes the linear notion of evolution. And you remember, he deals with that in the last paragraph of War and Peace and the Global Village. So you got revolution, the media's massage, then jumps into what is education in a revolutionary period and what is revolutionary, the people or the technology. Then the last paragraph of War and Peace and the Global Village deals with evolutionary metaphors. And McLuhan then leaps into cliched archetype. And then from that into the pollution. So it's revolution, education, evolution. No, what? Yeah, revolution, education, evolution, and pollution. Those are the four themes that are looked at through the hendiadys of technology and culture, disguised as the word medium. So I thought that was a grand new way to talk about McLuhan. So let's see if Bob Logan is aware of these four dynamics.
Yeah, I guess in my base way, Bob, I'd say I heard that as you were talking about ecology, eating, digestion, and shitting.
Okay, let me see that. Where's education there?
Because the education is eating.
Okay, and digestion is?
Revolution.
Revolution. Shitting is pollution.
Yep.
And where's evolution?
I had it as ecology, but that was a bit of just, I'm not sure that fits.
Right, but not bad. That would be Joyce's take, James Joyce's take on it. He's the one who made a lot out of the digestive tract.
Yeah, well, the more you think about the digestive tract, the more, the weirder it becomes. But, okay, anyway, so let's go and talk about Logan. Logan's an interesting guy. I met Logan in 2004, actually, when I was in Toronto, and I have to say, firstly, before starting, as a personal guy, he's a nice guy. He was amicable, friendly, and helpful.
Yes, and my first experience was in May 1975. I came up from New York. Did I say that my first experience was Logan? Did I say the words with Logan?
Yes.
I don't know if I did. Okay. May 75, I have Nam June Paik's assignment to give McLuhan the May 5th, 1975 New Yorker that had a big piece on Nam June Paik. When he knew that I was going to the center, he says, give this to the professor. So I did that. So I was around the center, dropping in every day for a week or two in the middle or latter part of May 75. And one day, Marshall said to me, let's go. And we start walking out the coach house, and all of a sudden there's another guy walking beside us. I don't know where he came from. He might have been coming around the corner, and Marshall saw him through the window and knew they were going to meet. And so we get outside, and we stride purposely along, and there's this tall guy. Well, not tall, but he might be a little taller than me or the same height, 5'9". And this Jewish guy is talking about physics and some other stuff. And we're walking towards a physics conference. Does this sound familiar? Ever tell you this story?
You've told me a variation of the story, but...
Yeah. So we walk across Queen's Park, and Bob is very actively engaging with McLuhan and ignoring me, and I'm just listening. We get to this conference, and it's for physicists, which is what Bob Logan was. And Bob says hello to a few people. A few people recognize Marshall. I sit in front of them. It's the only seat, the only third seat is in front of them, about like five rows back from the front. It's a big auditorium. And McLuhan and Bob are beside each other behind me. So the first physicist gets up, the lights go out, and the physicist starts showing the slides of his theory. And within 5 minutes, there's two snoring going on behind me. Two people are snoring, Logan and McLuhan. McLuhan, he was always napping, so he fell asleep. But Logan, I guess trying to be simpatico with McLuhan, falls asleep too. So my first impression, memory of him, is sleeping beside McLuhan in the darkened auditorium, ignoring this physicist. Now, I found the physicist interesting. I hadn't been to many physicist conferences before, and so I remember like paying attention to whatever he was trying to say. And so then all of a sudden, a little while later, Marshall woke up, jumped up, and walked out and left Bob sort of just sitting there and left me there. A little while later, I went back to the coach house, and McLuhan and I went up to a place where I got on a streetcar, and we went up to a place where he was going to get some acupuncture from Don Gay up at 235 St. Clair Avenue West, and it was right beside 219 St. Clair Avenue West, Unbeknownst to me is where the Evergreens were holding their meetings and starting in 74 and 75. And this is the spring of 75. McLuhan's right beside the building. And he or some of his family had a session with the Evergreens in 67. According to Mary McLuhan, she had the brochure there, the outline of the session. Anyways, I thought that proximity of McLuhan going to get 70s kind of medicine, new medicine, acupuncture, that was new back then. Carolyn later became a friend of Don Gay in her work in Toronto in the 80s and early 90s. So some interesting dialogue happened there on the way to, on the streetcar and that. And then when I read McLuhan's biography, Marchand's biography of McLuhan, where he's talking about him and Ted Carpenter doing hijinks in subways or in streetcars,
yeah,
talking about the advertising, I thought back and I remembered that McLuhan was talking about the ads and doing that. I understood what Carpenter was talking about because McLuhan really stood out in the subway. He was just talking, booming away about whatever he was talking about. And I was noticing people wondering, who's this guy, this boorish man talking and saying strange words? You know, that. And I remember him looking at the ads. I don't know if he commented on too many of them, but we were talking about the meaning of my play, Hand Signals for the Blind, which I started off, first called it, my first title I presented to him was Center for Director of the Center for Culture and Technology. That was the title of my play, well, at least how I presented it to him. And he was arguing about that title, or he had some different views of it. And later, when I changed
saying,
the handshake,
is he saying what? Too long, Bob. Too long. What is it?
No, that's the later when he hears next year. Hears I changed the hand signal for the blind. That's when he says, "No, it should just be hand signals." He didn't like the for the blind, and so I told you that, and I may.
Yeah,
I think that was too long, but I think he said the director of Center of Culture Technology was too long. I think you're right. Yes. Both were too long, basically. Both titles were too long.
Yeah, you told me some great stories, I think, where McLuhan's telling talking about Coke commercials and, like, very loudly pointing out the Coke suckers on the subway. Totally inappropriate behavior.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's Carpenter's story. That's, I think, more Carpenter-type stories. But I'm not sure. I don't recall me saying that. Okay? But maybe I did say something. I don't recall the details right now. I just more just think of how he's tall, and he's making everybody look like Lilliputians on the streetcar. You just get that vibe that this giant is talking among the little people, you know? And I was observing that. But the point is, this is my first image of Logan, a keen guy just getting to know McLuhan and talking, well, trying to keep up with McLuhan in whatever they were talking about. And that's my first experience of Bob Logan. I then would see him at the Monday night seminars in 76, 77, 78, 79. And I won't say what I say. And basically, Bob is a polite guy like a professor. A professor's polite to all students, right? Generally. He's a polite, sociable guy. And so you were a student, you know, so he's nice to you.
Yeah, there's a basic diplomacy there. So just for the sake of history, so I think Bob Logan comes onto McLuhan's radar when he's teaching a course called The Physics of Poetry and the Poetry of Physics, or something very close to that.
Yeah.
Okay, and there's actually, I think he's got one of his books out by then. So we're talking about this article here, and
I don't think he has any books. I don't know of any books that Logan did other than the alphabet of, you know, the first one, the alphabet of, what is it, the mother invention, the alphabet mother invention. That comes out in 86. I'm not aware of any books. There may have been.
Yeah, no, there is. I'm looking at it right here. It's called The Poetry of Physics and the Physics of Poetry. It's actually quite nice.
What's the date? I had never seen that.
2010.
Yeah, that's later. I mean, he worked on it probably for 30 years, I guess.
Yeah, presumably. It's just a really, really nicely written book that takes a lot of the principles of quantum physics, quantum mechanics into the everyday language. As to it actually addressing its title, in terms of the actual poetries of physics, I'm not sure that it actually gets there, but hey.
Okay, so what did I witness? In 1975, Logan introducing the world of physics to Marshall. I'm taking Marshall to a physics conference, and Marshall didn't last long. I fell asleep in 5 minutes. 15 minutes later, left the conference. So Marshall wasn't too impressed with physics as it was being presented. Did Logan understand that Marshall was the new physicist? That's what I don't know. We're going to see, maybe, whether Logan understands that. Don't call McLuhan a poet and think that's the contrary, like a different culture to physics. Marshall was the artist legislating what the state of matter was. Okay? That's the real physics that he was dealing with. And I don't know if Logan understood that. I maybe check his book out, but I wouldn't make the distinction between poetry and physics. That's simplification, which it seems to be Bob's forte. So let's see how he simplifies Marshall. So where should we begin?
Yeah, well, simplification is the point. Okay, so it's quite a long article, as per a lot of these McLuhan centenary things, and the insights per line are is way down there. So let's start, I think, on paragraph 3. He says, "The purpose of this expository essay is to clear up some of the misunderstandings and misconceptions about his work being McLuhan's work. No attempt will be made to apologize to McLuhan's scholarship or ideas, as no apology is needed." Nice point. "Rather, the objective is to make his work more accessible to a larger audience and to identify the origin of some of his key concepts." Blah, 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 blah. Okay, so...
I want to react to that.
Yeah.
What we've seen in the centenary, the various journalistic articles, New York Times, Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, and other newspapers, they make McLuhan accessible to a larger audience. And it's disgusting. You get no clue. And if anybody wants to become famous as a thinker or something and thinks that you'll make a contribution, no. You will be reduced by the journalistic mean to nothing. And so we don't need making McLuhan understandable. You'll just get the level that is presented in journalism. We've got to point out that the Global Village phrase came from Wyndham Lewis, not McLuhan. That the medium as a message doesn't refer to a new technology. It refers to an older bunch of technologies. That you've got to start complexifying McLuhan. Because you and several others became very depressed at looking at the journalistic simplification of McLuhan. And so Logan's job is obsolete. This is my first reaction. We do not need it. Now, let's say he's actually going to complexify McLuhan a little bit by clearing up what the simplifications have obscured. So he's going to make accessible, maybe, at best, the more sophisticated understanding of McLuhan. That's what I'm going to see if he does. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. There's an interesting tension I've noticed in McLuhan's own work is with regards to the simplification and complexification of his own work. Like a writing to Kenner way back in 51, McLuhan's saying that he's writing, that he's got a sense that they're writing for the Gideons and the... Gill songs, and they're trying to get Finnegan's Wake across to them.
They're writing to the elite, the actual elite right there.
The absolute, absolute elite. Yet, at the absolute end of his career, where he's working with somebody called, what's his name?
James Greenberg.
No. Okay, so writing to Monsignor Panzeroli in 58, he's saying that he's putting Ong down for offering a simplification of his work. And then in 76, writing to Jim Striegel, McLuhan seems to be promoting a simplification of his work.
Well, that's the fad in the mid-70s of what's called in education back to basics.
Yeah.
And he started to say that he was providing basics. So the times have changed. Now, who is the last colleague that you were trying to remember? What context are you talking about?
Jim Striegel, I believe, and I think that they were working on a book with that addressed the hemispheres.
Oh, okay. No, I'm not aware of that. So you're saying he says to, at the end of his life, he says he's trying to be simple, basic?
Yeah, well, at least within the bounds of that collaboration.
Okay, so you're talking about he's gone to Elite and had another, the complex of it, not sure. I had a couple of thoughts as you were saying. He's signed to Elite, Gilles Song, in the 50s. Then in the 60s, he's talking not to the academic elite, but to the Kissingers and Druckers. So the technocratic elite. Then he is kicked out of the elite in the 70s, so he's trying to start over again and get a populist movement going, and that's when Eric calls him Mao Zedong.
Yeah. Yeah. But going back to that, Kenner, it's so they're talking about getting across this awareness of Finnegan's Wake, and so at the same time he's talking about talking to the Gideons and Gilsons, he's also say that they are matters which will make Joyce of immediate concern to non-literate blokes. So he's whether he's talking the Norbert Wieners.
I need to read that slowly. What did you read or say?
Okay, so I'll read the whole section. Well, this letter is also tentative. Let me have your reaction to the idea that we write for the Gideons and Gilsons. Hence, importance of getting F Wake, so Finnegan's Wake, across to them. I have made a lot of Joyce discoveries, one which greatly will simplify your work in presenting him. But they are also matters which make Joyce of immediate concern to the non-literate blokes.
Oh, okay.
So I don't know whether he's talking about non-literates in the sense of a general audience or non-literates in the sense of the Norbert Wieners.
Right. Are they the post-literates? Non-literate can be post-literate.
Yeah, totally.
Let's see. So, and he also writes a letter to Innes around that time in 51, trying to get that elite. See, McLuhan is trying to find, he's not arrived yet. He's just a young guy, up-and-coming person with potential. So he sees the elite, he wants to get noticed by the elite. But in the 60s, he's the elite. And he makes fun of those old fuddy-duddy elites.
Yeah.
And he's moved out of academia into the global theater and talking to the intelligence agencies and the Kissingers and the people who manufacture the word that makes the market. And then remember how he says in by 75 on a couple of TV interviews, he's saying, this environment we're in makes everybody into nobody. If you're at a ball game, everybody's nobody. Think of it, I hadn't thought of this before. He's addressing himself. He's now a nobody. And everybody's a nobody because the entertainment society has taken over and sport and the instant replay. So think of this autobiographical. He's now a nobody, and he is forced to engage in Spadina Expressway issues and abortion issues, like be part of the local community and form a position, a point of view, which he can't do, and he gets in local trouble when he fails to do that panel with the feminists on abortion. Have you ever seen any of that? Do you know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, I do.
So he's actually miming the obsolescence of the elite in the 70s. So simplifying it, he's telling Don Thiel in the late 50s to don't explain, do not reduce Marshall, keep it mysterious. And then he really makes himself mysterious with War and Peace and Global Village by throwing those Finnegan's Wake quotes into the book, right? It's more complex than the medium is a massage. And then here he is trying to save Western civilization. He's saying this simplicity, back to the basics, is, well, let's just try to save something of Western civilization. And it'll be my stuff that we'll save, and I'll make it simple.
Yeah, somewhere McLuhan talks about a theory of communication being as simple as figuring out what change or transformation took place in the person within one reader that they believe ought to take place in others. Okay, and so I was just wondering, what do you think Logan's going on about in terms of why is he trying to make McLuhan more accessible? What did McLuhan do to Logan that he's trying to make possible for others?
Well, that's the Jewish kibbutz part of Bob. He's Jewish. I understand he goes to Israel a lot. That's the professor in him. He's trying to help the local kids It makes physics simple. Make McLuhan. He's trying to. It has a kind of snobbish thing that he has something that's so complex that nobody's intelligent enough to get it. So we'll make it simple for you. It's not a healthy way of presenting McLuhan, because he's ignoring the fact. This speech and article was done a few months before all the articles in the newspaper came out in July around McLuhan's birthday. And it'd be interesting to ask him what he thinks of those articles. I mean, I find Alex Kuskas saying that the article by Michael Volpe in the Globe and Mail was very interesting is sick. That was a bad article. It was a hit job on McLuhan. And, these guys up in the Toronto 100 group up there, the McLuhan 100, I don't think they have any media sophistication.
No, if it's got any association with McLuhan, it's got to be good. It gets the tick through.
What, say that again? If what has any association?
If any cultural output has any association with McLuhan, it gets ticked through as being quality at the moment.
It's, as quality?
Yeah, or as, this is a good article because it uses the word McLuhan. So this group of accountants will pass it through as good.
Yes, okay, this person sent in his proper tax receipt. They paid their proper... Yeah, McLuhan paid his taxes. He's okay. Okay, I just realized I have Logan in the Diasporic School of Mediacology. That's the fourth school that comes after the Barry Nevitz scene. This is after McLuhan transitioned, died, passed on, or faked his death, or got assassinated, whatever level you want to take. McLuhan was not too available after New Year's Day 1981. So you had Barry Nevitz leading the Toronto School of Media Ecology. Although I did find ways to get access to McLuhan through the Evergreens, but that wasn't until 1988. So there was a dearth of McLuhan from 81 to 88. And so Barry Nevitz filled it in with the first retrieving of the School of Media Ecology, we call it the Toronto School. The second school was New York, Saber Lautrengé with the Semiotech series that started in 1983. And then the third school was the Montreal School around Croker and Concordia in the late 80s. And then the fourth school was the Diasporic School. That's Bruce Powell, Neil Postman, Bob Logan, Derek DeKirchhoff, one or two other guys, can't remember right now, who are trying to preserve humanist literary POB, print-oriented bastard values. They recognize that literacy is in trouble, the book world is in trouble. I mean, that's Bruce Powell's first book is A Climate Charge, talking about the state of Canadian literature and how it's so embedded with university culture and professors. And being a writer, you almost starve unless you become a professor. So they're concerned about the role of books and Gutenberg values, and they have to acknowledge that something is happening that's marginalizing literacy. So how are we going to revitalize literacy? Or the print book meme. This is where Bob is a professor in the university, and universities are the capital of the Gutenberg values. He is there trying to impart an emphatic message to the forlorn students. It's a center margin structure, a one-way teaching situation. That explains Bob's simplifying for the supposed literate students, or at least saving literacy via McLuhan. And that requires homogenization and reducing McLuhan to one level. Right, that's pretty good summary of what we're going to see here.
Okay, so let's move on through.
Yeah, let's repeat what I'm about to say.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll come to understand or lose sight of what we're talking about, and then regain sight again as we move on through. Moving over the page. The next point that I was struck by is Bob says, despite his claim not to work from any theory or particular point of view, many have branded him, pejoratively, as a technological determinist. We will show that he was a technological determinist, but he was a soft determinist in the sense that technology by itself was not the only factor that determined human behavior, but that it was one of many contributing factors that needed to be reckoned with. So this comes back to the points that you opened with, Bob, on Hendiades.
Yes. Here's the thing. If you look at Eric's listing of they're called topics or features of Manipian satire. This listing in his PhD, not in his book, what is it, Thunder's Opinion is Weight.
Yeah, The Role of Thunder.
Yeah, that book is 1997. It's his 1982-83 PhD where you get a whole section on Manipian satire that's not included in The Role of Thunder. And it's a very useful, very useful inventory of characteristics. One of them is, if you're a Manipian satirist, you're going to treat language as a technology, and you're going to put on the technological determinist position that people are robots of the linguistic / technological environment. That's a feature of Manipian satire. So Bob has to point out the satirical point of being a technological determinist. Because the satire is, people are victims of puppetry if they're not aware of what's going on. So McCohen is describing the world of manners and media when people are subject to the poetic strings that media environments determine around you. Now this is the horizontal school of symbolism. You read Marshall, and I quote it in my essay on the different schools of media ecology, where he talks about the vertical symbolist teaches people to transcend, to get out of the environmental muck through moral rigor, discipline, other means, generally the Western 19th century educational mandate. But the horizontal school says we're stuck in a world of mirrors and you have to annihilate yourself and confront the puppet master. And that puppet master is in ancient Manipian satire is some demonology, some Gnostic demon. But, and that was what Lewis would call the, in the Childermass, what's that guy called? The broadcaster? Forget, the bailiff.
The bailiff, yeah.
The bailiff idea. But McLuhan turned the bailiff, turned it away from an anthropomorphic, you know, Hitler kind of figure, or just a totalitarian figure, to the technology itself as the bailiff. So, it is correct to say that McLuhan says you are technology determined if you don't know that you are determined by technology. And I'm here not to prove that you're a robot. I want you to become aware of it so you can regain your autonomy. If that's what is the soft determinist goal, then Bob is right. But that simplifies what already is a simplified name-calling, complexified by bringing up the point that McLuhan said that he was a Manipian satirist. What is he a satirist of? He is a satirist of people are dupes of technological determinism. That would put an element of poetic aestheticism to McLuhan's project, which is, it's time we put that level in now. Because that would intrigue young students. They know that technology determines their life because they get it through the Android meme, and they don't know that the Web 2 phase makes them feel superior to technology. They don't know the determinist aspect of that. But to get McLuhan as an interesting figure for them, tell them that he's a John Stewart. You know, get them to identify what they're familiar with and project that into McLuhan.
Okay, so the way that you just said that, I'm immediately thinking of McLuhan versus Karl Marx. Here in so far as you said that he's a satirist of dupes of technological determinism.
Yes, McLuhan says right in Mechanical Bride that, and that shows you McLuhan knew the media was a message long before he uttered it, and that he was looking at the situation. Even see him dimly saying it in some of his youthful Manitoban articles.
Yeah,
he's talking about the internationalist flavor due to technologies of the day. You know what I mean? And this is a threat for any nationalist ambitions or local culture. Okay, back to Marx. He says in Mechanical Bride that the fact that the means of production determine the society is made clear and is original to Marx. He gives him the kudos to that. But then he goes on and says, okay, technologies determine us, but it's not just hardware production services. It's the software levels of the 20th century that Marx meets. But the idea that the medium is the massage, that's already given. McLuhan says it's in art and it's in politics and sociology with Karl Marx. It's the flipping of it and the use of it satirically in his literature, and then the application of modulating it with the computer. He sees the way to use the computer not to be an update of two-bit wit of accounting, yes and no, who gets the debts and rewards. It's using the computer to modulate a new century communist. That Marx did not foresee. So to begin is that McLuhan figured out that modern electric technology allows us to overcome the technological determinist fate of the mechanical phase and the Gutenberg phase, which makes man a robot for the past 500 years.
Yeah, so there's an interesting dance there between McLuhan as a technological determinist and then McLuhan as not a determinist. I know that he's saying he talked to the American Assembly of Collegiate Schools of Business in 77, where he said, I'm not here engaged in trying to prove a materialist determinism of historical change, since the very idea of determinism, of linear cause and effect, supposes a continuity and connectedness that never existed in any historical situation.
Yeah, and I would add to that that he was trying to point out the new non-connected determinism.
Yeah.
The non-visible sensory modalities and their extensions were causing a curious kind of determinism in the 60s that felt everybody wanted to do their own thing under the satellite theater effect and become their own actor. They didn't know that that was determined. All the events of the mid-decade of the 70s determined by the increasingly computerized environment. It's the effects of the technological determinism that he's illustrating as they change through a 30-year period. And he's saying the colors of the technological determinism change.
Yeah, I get it. So one of the odd things then about this Logan's treatment of technological determinism here is the first thing you do, well, I would have thought, would be to talk about how McLuhan understands technology, for starters, because McLuhan's not talking about technology in the same way that most people think about technology.
Right.
So I think in my thesis I play this up in terms of radio. So radio, according to McLuhan, is merely a name for all the electric and simultaneous services which create the instantaneous surround of information that is itself acoustic in form and structure. So the actual physical device is such a tiny thing. He says again to Melvin Kranzberg, structurally in figure ground terms, the ground precedes and includes the figure before the figure as such emerges to perception. So in that sense, cinema exists before cinema is even shown.
Yeah, there's the determinism of the artist anticipating the effects before the science makes the technology. So there's multiple levels of determinism going on. Look at the, I think it's in The Ancient Quarrel of Modern America, written in the 40s. If you have that, you can quickly look it up. He talks about the Stoics believed that that the word was a reflection of the universe. Maybe they used God or the gods. And then the mind was a reflection of the Logos. So yeah, it was the Logos was mind by society, and the mind of man was mind the society, which mind the Logos. It's a Stoic idea, technological determinism or environmental determinism.